My name is Catherine Gunn, and I used to work at GCHQ back in 2001 to 2003. And I blew the whistle on the NSA and GCHQ's attempt to subvert the UN Security Council in order to get authorization for the Iraq War. So I leaked it, and I was charged with breaking the Official Secrets Act. And then they dropped the charges against me.
Now, it does seem
So,
this time that they're not even interested in whether it's legal or not, Catherine.
this is the thing, is that, since 2003, since the invasion, I mean, actually, the invasion of Afghanistan didn't have any legal permission either, as far as I know. I was just assumed that, they harbored Al Qaeda networks, and therefore they could be attacked. Hello, are you still there?
Yep, I'm still here. Carry on.
And the Iraq War, the invasion, bombing and invasion of Iraq, it was massively opposed by the British population and most of the world population as well. In the run up to it, they had to gin up a whole lot of excuses and propaganda in order to try and soften the public for permission for bombing and invading. And there were major protests and so on by the public. And Tony Blair obviously was up for a general election fairly shortly thereafter, and he was determined to get back into position. Obviously, the status quo, the establishment, wanted him back in position. So they insisted that there was some sort of legal cover, UN authorization for the invasion, but they were prepared to go about it in duplicitous ways in order to get that permission and authorization by the majority of the UN Security Council. In all, and it failed. It failed partly because I leaked the information that they were basically eavesdropping on UN Security Council members, and also because France and Russia were not in favor of it, really. So they ended up not having authorization to invade Iraq, but they still went ahead and did it. And because they get away with these things on the public stage, they're not charged with war crimes, that there's no there are no consequences for their criminal behavior. And so it just rolls on and it carries on. And that's why we've got to this moment in time where they just blatantly bomb and kidnap whoever they want because they know that there is no consequence for their actions.
So who are they?
The Anglo-American Zionist Deep State Network.
And what's their objectives? Because it doesn't even seem that, I mean, we've got US senators, etc., saying there is no actual plan.
Well, there is a plan because it was drawn up by the Brookings Institute in 2009, the document called Which Path to Persia. That is the plan. That is what they're actually following, more or less, although they're having to speed it up because they have realized, that Iran actually is far more capable than they anticipated.
Can you tell us a bit about this, the actual plan? Because they certainly haven't put that out in the mainstream press, have they?
No, well, the man who's been repeating this over and over and over for many, many years now is the former US Marine and current political, geopolitical analyst, Brian Berletic. And he has a YouTube channel called The New Atlas. And basically, he's been repeating this ad infinitum about this document from 2009, the w Witch Path to Persia. It's actually quite a thick publication, as far as I know. I haven't read it, but it talks about how they will attack Iran, and now it seems, as they're mentioning, they're going to have to resort to various minority groups in and around Iran to do the dirty work for them. And this is actually also written, I mean, it is part of the plan that was Witch Path to Persia. It's within that document. So they're trying to get the Kurds involved, and various other minority groups.
Yeah, so people might know him as Land Destroyer or Tony Cartellucci. He's gone under various different names. He's finally come out as who he really is. But look, at the end of the day, surely here, or not the end necessarily, but the British have come out of this reasonably well, in that the Prime Minister is basically saying Keir Starmer is still clinging on, that the war isn't legal, and so he's being as restrained as he possibly can on it.
Well, clearly they're nervous about this because of the ICC's or ICJ's definition of genocide by what Israel was doing to Gaza. So there is a shift in terms of global power politics, and I think they're just hedging their bets. And Starmer is basically his name is Mud. He's probably the meanest of British history, even worse than Blair by the end of his tenure. He's clinging on to power because he is a member of it. He's been tasked with obviously rolling out certain plans within the UK or allowing for certain global scenarios to carry. But the fact is, Cyprus is deeply involved, and Cyprus is virtually a protectorate, and they're allowing the US to use their base. But they're also using it themselves. They've been very much involved in the war on Gaza, doing surveillance flights and God knows what else, because they keep it very much under the cover of darkness. So, Declassified have done some brilliant exposés of what's been going on in Cyprus, how the British military and the government are refusing to come clean about what they're actually doing with Gaza. So therefore, they're probably also involved with what's going on in Iran, but they're also keeping a storm about it.
So Starmer may be, maybe there's nobody else that could really do this, and Starmer is the person that they've desperately got to keep him. Well, what did you make of the arrest of Peter Mandelson? Because he's been quite an important figure in British politics over, gosh,
Sorry,
decades, actually.
you broke up. I didn't hear that last
Yeah,
bit.
sorry, yeah.
Tony, you just broke up and I didn't get most of that.
Okay, well, let's just pause a second.
Nope, can't hear you.
No, well, I'm not saying anything. I'm just pausing. So, what
I
did you
see.
make of Mandelson's arrest? He's quite an important figure in British politics, really stopping renationalisation after Thatcher, etc., and steering the Labour Party into becoming pro-Israeli. Have you gone?
Yeah, this internet connection, I don't know if it's yours or mine. It's a bit choppy. I got most of what you said about Mandelson. Obviously, he's, a key node in this network, clearly from before even the time of Tony Blair. They're obviously, they're all compromised to some extent. Not only that compromised, but I think they basically all enjoy their own peccadilloes. I mean, it's not just that they're compromised, that they actually, enjoy that sort of lifestyle. That is who they are. And they're using, I think they're basically taking out the non-Jewish elements of this Epstein network, hanging them out to dry as a sort of panacea for a sop to the whole, outcry about the Epstein cabal. That's why they're going after the names that basically people are already familiar on the n list, like the man formerly known as Prince, and obviously Mandelson and the Clintons and so on. These are people who've been named before, maybe not Mandelson, but he was certainly a sketchy figure, and people knew he was sketchy. Nothing much beyond that has come out really in the mainstream media. So I think they're trying to still keep the biggest, most influential figures of this deep state multinational, network out of the public eye.
Yeah, because Donald Trump is apparently there's a big section missing from the Department of Justice release, which is a 14-year-old girl who testified that she was molested by Trump, introduced to her. He was introduced to her. She was introduced to him by Epstein at Mar-a-Lago, and this is all missing from the files.
I'm sure there's a lot missing. I mean, already we know that, another 3 million plus documents are, as far as we know, still not released. But beyond that, those are documents. Those are just the, emails and messages and so on and so forth. The actual bulk of the videos and photos and so on, those are also not yet released, as far as I'm aware, not many of them. And furthermore, I've heard that they're already deleting some of the stuff that has been released. They're actually going through and deleting stuff. So, and it's clearly there is a huge, an absolutely phenomenal amount of information already within those 3 million documents that people are start already been doing a great job of combing through them and piecing things together. Especially, for example, about the influence of Epstein and Gates and so on with the COVID affair, and how, they prepped the whole thing, the whole money-making scheme behind it, has been drawn out by analysts who've been looking into it.
I mean, we talked to you, Catherine, a lot during COVID. What do you think this release has taught us about what was going on then? And what can you just refer to some of the revelations that? Because I mean, I think don't think this is. I haven't seen much reference to COVID in the mainstream press with these releases.
No, well, clearly they don't really want that exposed either, because the whole thing was basically very much a money-making scheme for these individuals, because they could get funding into these issues because they're considered to be, in the public interest. So things like investing in vaccine research and investing in diagnostics and so on with the WHO and all of that, people working in those sectors would have not necessarily seen it as problematic, because clearly they felt these were good things that were being done for the public health. But there have been WHO whistleblowers. There was one lady in particular who came out during the actual period during COVID, and I can't remember her name off the top of my head at the minute, but she was a European lady who spoke excellent English, but she worked really deep within, she was very she created a lot of the teaching material, health teaching material that was put out by the WHO. And she said that, when the WHO actually got most of its funding from Gates and the Gates Foundation, it swiveled dramatically from basic health and hygiene, sanitation and hygiene, ensuring clean water, and encouraging sort of breastfeeding and all that kind of basic health and hygiene for ensuring the longevity of youthful populations, especially in Africa and Southeast Asia and so on. And it swiveled from that to vaccines under the Gates funding. And obviously, there's a massive profit motive. I mean, the whole thing is a profit motive. It's Gates himself said that vaccines gave him 20-to-1, I think, investment opportunities in an interview that he gave. So this whole the whole COVID scam was carefully sort of organized around how they could maximize profits on medical interventions and diagnostics.
Okay, so what about this Epstein network? You've talked in the past about this Pax Judaica, which is the idea of a kind of almost like a parallel government, a parallel network around the world where people are sort of imposing their decisions on vast populations. But how does that it link up with Epstein? I mean, I must say I prefer to call it Pax Xionica, but I'm probably in a minority of one. Lots and lots of people now recognizing that there is this Zionist Israeli related network, almost like a mafia, which seems to be pulling the strings. So is that part of the Epstein? How does Epstein fit into that?
Well, clearly Epstein was Jewish, and he was part of this Wexner, another key Zionist and Jewish multi-billionaire oligarch in the US. He's been qu questioned by this committee in the US, questioning people under oath. And of course, with his advanced age and so on, he feigned a lot of sort of confusion and what have you. But in actual fact, he's a member of the early Jewish mafia in the US, that got really embedded into the American, all the different sectors of American society in the civil service and corporate networks, which is, you know, very ably documented by Whitney Webb in her two-part massive tome, One Nation Under Blackmail. And she names a lot of these figures and explores all the connections between them. It goes, you know, back a long way. I mean, you could argue that it's a sort of supremacist mindset within a certain segment of society that, I don't know, I'm theorizing, but it maybe coincides with a sort of aristocratic mindset of supremacism combined with the very extreme version of the Jewish idea of chosenness or supremacy, which, you know, possibly this is what links them, this story they tell themselves about how they're better than the rest of us. And interestingly enough, I recently discovered through a video I watched by another very good professor of history and analyst of geopolitical events, Justin Podder, who has a podcast called the Anti-Empire podcast, I think. And he explained that in fact, the Iranian diaspora around the world, who are generally speaking the so-called monarchists, they support the Shah and are basically jubilant about the bombing of Iran and the killing or assassination, murder of the Ayatollah Khamenei. And these people apparently also consider themselves the true Iranians, and not the people in Iran they consider to not be Iranian. It's quite extraordinary. And in fact, I have a personal experience of this, because I met this Iranian lady in Turkey many years ago. She was on holiday here with her family, and she was a lovely lady, very nice. And eventually, because we stayed in touch, my daughter and I visited her and her family just outside Copenhagen in Denmark somewhere. I can't remember exactly where. Anyway, I thought, you know, they were a lovely family and so on. But recently I've seen on her public Facebook post, or, well, on Facebook where she's posting, that she's one of these jubilant Iranian diaspora. And she's sort of, yeah, jubilant about the assassination of the Ayatollah. And one of her posts, which was in Iranian, but, or no, anyway, I had to translate it on Facebook. But she's talking about protests. Presumably they were anti-war protests that were being held near where she lived in Denmark. But she said, "I don't understand," she said, "why they're protesting," she said, "but that might explain for 47 years, Iran has been occupied by fundamental non-Iranians who have propagandized as a mission around the world. If those at this location in Denmark where they were protesting, if those people were Iranians, they would celebrate Khamenei's death and not mourn." Vomit emoji. And when I saw that, I was quite disturbed, you know, because she, as far as I had experience of, was a lovely person. But clearly, she's also a person who, as described by Justin Podor as Iranian diaspora, she believes the people living in Iran currently, those that support the Iranian government and are out protesting in the streets against the American and Israeli bombardment, they are non-Iranians, according to her. So I don't know who she thinks they are and where she thinks they've been and where they came from. But again, so it's this supremacist, different, chosen, we're not one of you type of ideology that's interesting that they're the ones that are the main aggressors.
You could say the same, I suppose, about the Israelis. Many of them are actually not from that part of the world. They're Europeans, and they've sort of imposed themselves upon indigenous Palestinians. But what do you? I mean, this is it's interesting. This idea that you can be sort of friendly with someone, chit chat with them for years before you realise, actually, gosh, they're supporting the absolute diametric opposite. And I've been quite, I mean, surprised, disappointed, but you know, these things are salutary lessons with Andrew Bridgen MP, who was such a good speaker in when he was an MP in the Commons against the vaccinations and made a very good and made a couple of several very good interventions about the dangers of these experimental gene therapies pretending to be vaccines. And then around about tail end of 2025, he's very openly come out as vehemently pro-genocide, pro-Israel, and you know, pro-Tommy Robinson, for goodness sake.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's many people have been finding this on, you know, the ones that ostensibly felt like they'd lost their place in the left because the left had universally embraced, on the whole, this emergency measures, so-called, and the lockdown and all these dangerous interventions, like you say, the jab and the toxic jabs and so on. And they felt, you know, many people in the left couldn't just didn't un didn't recognize their colleagues, comrades on the left, and so they sort of turned to the right and noticed there were some people on the right who were also saying the same things as them, so they kind of became this first time in probably history, a sort of non-partisan protest group that together protest against all these authoritarian measures. But however, after that, you know, there was actually, there was probably a certain degree of agreement with those on the right about the Ukraine and Russia situation, because I think many on the right would also side probably with Russia. However, when it came to Gaza and, of course, Iran, it's a different story. Now, clearly, you could say there is a racial element to it. If you were being sort of magnanimous, and they insist that, of course, they're not racist, they don't have a racist bone in their body, if they make that claim, then I suggest possibly it might have something to do with this idea that you must support the minority. because the minority must be right on an issue. And so if you have sort of minority voices on the issue of Palestine, for instance, some Palestinians who have gone over to the side of Israel and who are basically trying to, who've identified with their oppressor and who are sort of claiming that life is brilliant if you just accept the whole Israeli doctrine about how things should be, that they can be happy. And so they've turned their backs on their community, they've turned their backs on the whole society that they came from, and they've embraced essentially colonial, settler colonial white supremacism. And they're obviously a minority voice, and the Israeli propaganda machine is using them very, very aggressively, I would say, in certain segments to try and persuade them that these are the genuine voices of Palestinians. And so people who are inclined to believe that the mainstream media is telling you lies, they will say, oh, listen to these, nobody's talking about them, and they're a minority, and they're trying to stand against this massive, block of people who are just repeating the mainstream talking points. And I think that may also apply to Iran. They sort of think, well, look at these people who've integrated into Western society in the West, and clearly they're well adapted, and clearly they think that, the mainstream media about Iran is wrong. However, the mainstream media story about Iran is that Iran is a menace and Iran is a dangerous country. The Iranian quote unquote regime needs to be toppled. So actually, they're going along with the mainstream on this, just as they went along with the mainstream narrative virtually on Gaza. So I don't know. I think maybe it boils down to racism at the end of the day, because they clearly think that the people who are born with brown and black skin are worth less than people who are born with, white or pale white, yellow, cream skin, whatever you want to call it. That's the only way I can see it, that they're identifying with their own being white. So it's still very much a tribal mentality.
Yeah, interesting. Well, what do you make of, I mean, considering that, what about China, particularly with the genocide and now with this open, illegal, both in terms of international law and domestic law, attack by Trump on Iran? I mean, the Chinese seem to have been very, actually very restrained. And I mean, considering that they are a permanent member of the UN Security Council, they could be surely doing a lot more. Not, I mean, I'm not talking here about financial, military help, etc., to Iran. I'm talking here about making powerful diplomatic moves at the UN to force votes on, and actually, of course, the Russians, I'm sure, will be quite happy to vote along with them. So why the Chinese seem to be so silent on this?
That's a good question. I don't know to what extent actually they could force a vote that would have meaningful results, because apart from Spain and apparently, even in Spain, it's the leadership is being forced really by the sentiment of the public. So they realize that their population is so vehemently, so fervently against genocide and against illegal invasions of countries that have not presented a direct threat, that the Spanish leadership has just barred Spain from being involved in this attack on Iran. And so the rest of European states, the rest of NATO states, including Japan and so on, they're not going to challenge the US at this stage, because I think the geopolitical balance is still not it's still not weighted on the side of China and Russia and the global South. We haven't got to that point yet. So China is clearly doing things. I just recently saw, and I don't know if it has been confirmed. Apparently, the commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, Ismail Kani, has been arrested on charges of spying for Mossad. Military commentator Vladislav Shurygin, citing sources, reports that Kani was arrested based on information provided by Chinese military intelligence. He was identified after one of his conversations with a senior representative of the US CIA and Israeli general staff was intercepted. So there's been some mention by people such as Justin Trudeau, who pays a lot of attention to what the Iranian media puts out and so on. But he said that, in terms of modern warfare, besides the military aspect, the kinetic aspect, there's the intelligence aspect, the signals intelligence aspect, and the electronic warfare aspect. And he suggested that China is helping on those fronts with satellite information and with interception. If this is true, based on this thing that I just mentioned about arresting this, I mean, senior commander, the head of the Al-Quds force of the IRGC, that's, if he was an internal traitor at such a high level, that's quite astonishing.
Well, it also means that the China could be helping in all sorts of ways, but very, very quietly. So, for example, with satellite intelligence saying, well, look, target this American truck. It's got a whole load of generals in it, this sort of thing.
Well, I think this has been going on because, for example, the hotels that in Dubai, which the military personnel from the bases apparently were temporarily transferred to, were, bombed. And there was another, I think, I mean, there have been various. You just can't keep up with all the military, minute by minute information, but there was some reference to a building where several CIA officials were bombed. And so that might hint at the possibility that China is providing them with intelligence.
I mean, it could also be the guy operating the lift in the hotel, couldn't it? I mean, there's.
Well, yeah,
But I
possibly.
mean, what about the psychological warfare side of it? Because the West seems to completely depend so much on the use of the press here to bamboozle people. What do you make of the way that the Western press has handled this? Because it seems to be almost, well, very, very blatant, the propaganda. We're hearing virtually nothing from Iran at all.
Well, I mean, they banned the Iranian TV, channel, oh, ages ago, and of course, RT has been banned for ages, and so yeah, obviously, the alternative sources of media, mainstream media, is just non-existent. But then again, the viewing figures for mainstream media clearly collapsed, and the vast majority of people are sourcing their information from, X or podcasts or various YouTubers that they follow and so on.
But there is Al Jazeera. What do you make of Al Jazeera?
Well, Al Jazeera is problematic because, of course, it's based in Qatar. It's associated with the Qataris, and they were atrocious on Syria. I don't really pay much attention to their reporting, to be honest, because of that. The thing that I'm concerned about is the fact that just as they used Al Qaeda as a bogeyman for the various wars against, the invasion of Iraq and then subsequently Syria, but they went ahead. This is why their stories are so far from it, just they're so crazy. You can't, anybody who actually pays attention to the news and that they don't have a goldfish memory, they'll, understand that we used to fight Al Qaeda and ISIS in Iraq, in Syria. And then, when they put the very head of Al Qaeda in Iraq as the president of Syria, then that whole narrative collapsed. And of course, they tried to rebrand him and repackage him, but it's not been all that successful. And
Yeah, they shaved his beard.
they shaved his beard, they put him in a suit. Yeah. And so the Al Qaeda boogeyman we know was basically their creation, and it was a bunch of mercenary guys who simply went along for whatever reasons they did. But now they've been crafting this other story and this other narrative, which is taking root now, and I don't know to what extent people are buying it, but that quote unquote Iranian sleeper cells. So, I mean, that they've been seeding this for a number of months now, going on for probably for a year or so. Various outlets, various analysts, various people who are probably part of the deep state have been seeding this story, and it's now gone into the mainstream. In fact, just today, I think Germany have warned, of course, Germany always jumps on the bandwagon. Germany warned that Germany may be at risk to Iranian sleeper cells. So they're trying to, there's very, very possibly going to be a false flag in some NATO country, whether it's the US or probably in more than one, because they like to do it in more than one place to reaffirm the danger. And it could well involve some sort of biological weapon, because that's a narrative that they haven't used yet, and they're trying to use that. So if they get that, then if that gets massive coverage in the media, as it would, because these stories always do, then they could potentially sway the US public for an invasion of Iran, boots on the ground. Or for even more severe control of the domestic situation. So, forcing, making the online world, as it were, taking away the anonymity of it, so that every interaction online can be traced to people's actual identities. That's one thing they're very determined to achieve. So they're using various different excuses to achieve this, child protection and so on. That's one issue that they've been using to drive at it. But I could well imagine they would use a sort of Iranian sleeper cell, like terrorist activity, where if they'd known people's identities online, they could have mailed it before it happened, that sort of thing. So it's all about getting us sort of all connected to this online avatar of us that. Where all of our information is collated in one place, and eventually, the potential for having CBDCs or some form of tokenized digital monetary token type thing, and our ID, so that they can real time surveil us. For everything, and restrict our behaviors, reward and restrict our behaviors based on our online activity and our real world activity, if, as our mobile devices are with us and are tracking us at all time. So this is what they want to achieve and what they're doing their utmost to achieve. Using these other events going on geopolitically.
Yeah, you talking about the false flags. Tucker Carlson has been reporting that there have been arrests of Mossad people both in Saudi Arabia and I think it was Dubai or UAE as well. They've arrested these Mossad agents who it looked as if were going to perpetrate terrorist attacks and then to try and blame that on Iran. So, I mean, it does sound as if what you're saying may potentially be absolutely on the cards right now. Also, I remember last week, or actually, no, it was 2 weeks ago. Things move quickly. The Russians were saying that they believed that the British were going to, they'd got intelligence the British were going to bring a nuclear weapon into Ukraine. So, I mean, it's two questions in one, which I should never really do. But I wonder if you think that this is there is some sort of link really between what's going on in Ukraine and what's happening in Iran, and also the point of these false flag attacks. Because you're right, whenever they happen, there's always a whole load of scripted narrative that just rolls out all across the press. In fact, you can quite often see channels all across the world using exactly the same script.
Yeah, I mean they did for COVID, and they do it for all sorts of global events. So I mean, the ultimate thing is obviously they still haven't destroyed Russia. They want to balkanize Russia, just as they balkanized Eastern Europe, and they balkanized. Essentially, they're trying and they're achieving to balkanize Syria. They want to completely do, refigure the whole of West Asia and balkanize it according to sort of ethnic and religious groups. And they want to do this across the globe. They want to do it in Russia. They want to do it in China. They want to break up all these strong nation states that have multiple ethnic and religious communities. Because ultimately, the technocrats, the new sort of Bilderbergers, the new generation, the people that are the sort of transhumanists, the nihilists, the ones who talk about the dark enlightenment, creative chaos, and all this kind of bull, they are aiming to destroy traditional structures. Civil society and turn it into a corporate oligarchy, basically a rule by private corporations, and we're beginning to see it in various ways in all of our societies, that you can't, that the NHS is now basically swallowed up by Palantir. The government, all of the civil service structures are now hosted on private corporate networks, and the information is being fed to private corporate entities. And ultimately, the goal of these individuals is that we will pay for everything, and this again, this goes back to that WEF sort of infamous advert that quickly got taken offline, which was the one that said by 2030 you will own nothing and you will be happy. And increasingly, they are driving us in that direction, whereby, we won't own our own home, we won't own our own vehicles, we won't own anything of any real worth, because they will, they will buy the different catastrophes and economic crises that occur. They will strip everyone of their physical assets, and ultimately, their plan is to tokenize everything and everything. It's just a totally insane plan to financialize things to infinitum, so each tree, can be tokenized to a billionth number of times. And it is just this enormous derivative, the biggest derivative bubble in recorded history. I mean, I don't think we'll see anything like it. We haven't seen anything like it. It would be an absolute catastrophe. It's an insane plan, and but it's these people's way of defrauding everybody and grabbing everything.
Look, one of the main players, you're talking about the NHS there, in fact, right across government in Britain, to do with Starmer, is this company called Palantir. They seem to be, well, very much connected with the American security state and very much the Bilderbergers, actually, many of them have financed it. Chief Executive Alex Karp, for example. And they seem to be getting into all sorts of areas of government. Now, some will probably say, well, you need to have integration across government into the digital world. But what do you think they're up to?
Well, as I said, they're basically, Palantir and Oracle, Larry Summers, who's another Zionist multi-billionaire oligarch. They're Malthusians, they're nihilists, they're basically they're psychotic. I mean, they're psychotic individuals, and if we actually implemented a sort of personality test, the personality test at the beginning of people's careers, you could probably weed out these people before they end up at the heads of corporations.
Oh, this is
But of
the
course,
irony is they're rewarded and they're actually
yes,
promoted.
they're everywhere. I agree. So actually, they probably do these tests and surreptitiously put these people forward because they know that they're all part of the same gang, the same sort of psychopathic Epstein class. But anyway, yeah, point taken. There's also, of course, this unacknowledged plan of depopulation, and one might argue that that's also going along quite swimmingly for them. With various drugs and all sorts of drugs pushed forward for people's so-called health that have absolutely catastrophic effects on their organs and their bodies. I mean, Ozempic and all these dietary pills, for example. I mean, they literally just want to make money off us, and then when they've squeezed us dry, they want to discard us. I mean, they see us as farm animals. I think that's quite clear for most people now. They regard us as no more than cattle or chickens. And when we've sort of finished being of any productive value, they will dispatch us. So it's a really charming view of the world, but it seems pretty evident to anybody who's paying attention.
Well, I mean, isn't it? I think it's fascinating that Martin Summers on our program was saying that that people used to go and seek out Epstein because they didn't care about what was going on in the house. They knew that if you went to see Epstein, you might well suddenly land a fantastic, well-paid, powerful job.
Right. I mean, as I say, these people don't have the same, they don't have morals or values that we would identify with. And one might argue they don't have any morals or values other than the satanic one, which is to do what thou wilt. And so that's quite clear that people who've allowed themselves to be consumed by that type of mentality will do anything to benefit themselves and possibly their immediate clan. But as far as it goes towards the Pax Judaica and I mean all of these oligarchs, Larry Summers, Peter Thiel, Larry, I mean, Les Wexner, Epstein, all the various other people, Leon Black, who's in the Epstein files, who hasn't been really focused on at all. And All, I mean, there's a huge list of them. In fact, Ryan Dawson, who is really the OG on the Epstein files, because he's gone through all the legal documents, all the transcripts, and so on, and he has created all the lists. Years ago, 10 years ago, he had the list of Epstein, the Epstein cabal. He had over 13 names at least.
Yeah, he was using the flight list, and he was also using this infamous phone directory.
Well, he was using various things, including those, but also court transcripts, as I said. He interviewed victims. He submitted via Freedom of Information the court transcripts that had already been sort of registered cases. And so he's documented all of many of the key figures. And so he's also got a website. He's heavily censored. He's no longer, for years, he's not been allowed to have a channel on YouTube. He's banned from Instagram. He's banned from PayPal. He's basically extremely censored. I don't agree with him on absolutely everything, but he has a website called, I think, the anti-neocon.com or something, I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, you can find these people, and they are inadvertently, the majority of them are either dual nationals or maybe Israelis themselves, and they're very, very pro-Israel. They are Zionists, and they have funded the Zionist project, the Israeli project, for decades. So you could argue that this is the nexus of the Pax Judaica. These are the people. This is the nexus. And people like Satan Yahoo, as I call him, they've been deeply entwined in this network as well for the last 50 plus years. And while it was being exposed, they were doing their utmost to keep a lid on the extent to which it is a Jewish network, a Zionist network, and so it continues.
But yeah, hang on. There is this
So.
million miles between Jewish and Zionists, really. I was just seeing the other day, the chief designer for the jet engine over in Nazi Germany was Jewish. It just so happened that he was pro-Zionist Jewish, and so the Nazis had looked after him. And they there was a the real hatred, it seems, in Nazi Germany was towards those Jews that weren't interested in going to Palestine, and weren't interested in Zionism. Those are the ones that went into the camps. But look, we really ought to touch on this aspect of the US policy, which is revealed this week by Middle East Eye, who've done actually a very good job, Oscar Rickett, chomping through these bits and pieces of evidence and pulling together the facts. United States troops have been told that the Iran war is anointed by Jesus to bring on Armageddon. Military Religious Freedom Foundation says it's received widespread complaints about what they call Christian nationalist US commanders in the military. There's an organization dedicated to ensuring all members of the US military are guaranteed their religious freedom from the Constitution. So they've been reported by Jonathan Larson, the journalist, but have come from 40 different units. One combat unit commander told NCOs the Israeli-US attacks on Iran are part of God's plan, and that the United States president was anointed by Jesus to light the signal fire in Iran to cause Armageddon and mark Jesus's return to Earth. Now, no wonder when the mainstream press are not reporting on this, and they're not telling the mainstream press anything about this. They're also Senator Blumenthal Yesterday was saying that they got a military briefing, all these American senators, and he said, "Well, there was nothing in the briefing that we had that was a threat to national security, that they should be saying this to the public, and it's being left to the conscience of senators to actually explain to the American public that there is no proper plan, and that actually it looks as if the US is already planning to put boots on the ground in Iran, even though the public's not being told." But anyway, so what do you make of this rather twisted religious aspect to the American plan behind the scenes?
Well, as I say, I mean, this ideology goes back a long way to the even to the senior Bush era, where I believe the senior Bush, George H. Bush, Papa Bush, he referred to them as the crazies, and you know they are in office, but I mean they're not in office by chance. They're, you know, the whole political structure is theater, and so whilst these people are saying these things, like the Hegseth is saying these things, and perhaps he does believe it. Perhaps he genuinely believes in the clash of civilizations, the Crusades, and how, you know, it's his duty and US's duty to destroy the enemy. However, I'm skeptical by these sorts of stories, because I think they're, you know, whilst they may be saying it to their troops and so on, they're trying to gin up this religious war to get the Christian Zionists to basically really buy into this whole thing. Now, there's a significant portion of the US public that are Christian Zionists. In fact, as Pastor Stephen Sizer has said before in his books that he's written about Christian Zionism, there are more Christian Zionists than there are Jews. So the Jewish lobby has been well aware of this, and they have cultivated and continued to sort of propagandize, you know, this Christian Zionist sector of the US, taking them on these trips to Jerusalem and so on, and showing them all this land. And the trouble, the irony, in fact, is that whilst the Christian Zionists, on the face of it, say they must defend Israel and defend the Holy Land and so on, but in actual fact, from my understanding, is that they believe that Jews are actually, they're going to have to convert to Christianity in order to be saved. So actually, they don't see Jews as being, you know, valid in terms of their religious authenticity and so on.
So what you're saying is that the Jews have to go to hell or convert to Christianity, basically.
Yes, and but of course, Jews also, theologically, the ones who are very extreme, they view Christians to be pagans because of course of the concept of Trinity. So they actually, you know, look down on Christians and think Christians are damned. So there's a real irony between this coordinated effort. So The question is, who is using who at this point? And is somebody, are there figures in the background who are clear on these issues and are playing both sides against each other? I mean, the whole concept of Christian Zionism came out of the UK, the whole Protestantism and the, I mean, I'm not really all that expert on this,
But
but
it got a
it
big
was
boost
the,
in America with the Scofield Bible and
yes, but it all began in Britain and with, I do believe the Rothschilds had a hand in funding the production of the Bible and
they
so
did,
on. But I
yeah.
mean, the actual supposed pastor who was tasked with crafting this Scofield Bible was, I believe, a fraudster, and so he wasn't even a genuine Christian preacher. But there was, amongst the Protestant Christians, and I don't know about amongst Catholics, but when the Bible was translated into the English languages and so on, and the native languages of Europe, there was a, I believe, a growing sense of anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism against the Jews for having, killed Jesus Christ.
Well,
And also,
Jesus himself was Jewish.
well, I don't want to go into all those details, but because I'm certainly not an expert, but I'm saying this is what I've come across over the years, that the sort of religious movements that were the sort of the whole Enlightenment period when and the Reformation and all of that, and the focus then on the New Testament instead of the Old Testament of the revengeful God and so on. The once people were able to read the Bible in their own language, they tended towards the New Testament and New Testament messages, and especially the more sort of new church, the new church movement in the UK, in England and Wales and so on, where they were very almost the sort of, anyway, I'm talking rubbish, I don't know what I'm talking about, but that I believe Stephen Sizer, in his book, he explains this movement from traditional Christianity, the understanding of Israel not as a group of people, but as a idea of the kingdom of heaven, and how it got completely altered and thus developed Christian Zionism.
Well, the most interesting side of this, it seems to me, is the links to the accelerationists and people like Peter Thiel, the people funding and Elon Musk, and Larry Ellison. You mentioned that, look, this lot, this is what they believe, apparently, that that Armageddon is a good thing, and that the good guys are those on the side of the Antichrist. So, there seems to be a sort of alignment towards. There are people who really are, and maybe for decades, movements have been pushing for this clash between the Zionists and the Muslims. But look, one of the most interesting people who's been, so for example, talking about the links between the genocide and human sacrifice in ancient times. And this is a sort of way of bringing it into the modern times. Is this guy, Zhang Zekun? I'm not sure quite how to pronounce him. Chinese Canadian lecturer. He does this predictive history channel, which has been getting hundreds of thousands of hits as he day by day explains in his terms this concept that there is actually a massive sort of spiritual aspect which the Western mass media is completely ignoring. And so many people are seeing his stuff. He's actually put something out this week, which I'll be probably using a little bit from, about the attack on Iran. But he does see much of what's going on today as a sort of reconstitution of Phoenician, Carthaginian, Aztec, the idea of public human sacrifice actually shocking people and being used to frighten, instill fear on a very sort of unconscious, subconscious level.
Well, yeah, you could. I mean, I haven't watched his more recent things. You could argue, and people have been arguing, other people have been suggesting that these non-stop horrors that are made public, that are shown over and over on or talked about at any rate. It's a form of it's tr a traumatizing, and it's repeat trauma, and it can overwhelm many people. Many people say that they just can't watch the news because it's too negative, it's too depressing, and there's nothing they can do about it. And I think many people feel this way and have felt increasingly this way. And so you could argue that, yeah, this is deliberate, that they do this deliberately to overwhelm our neural, overwhelm us emotionally and psychologically and mentally. Some people, well, most of us, we can't sort of keep seeing this stuff over and over. It can cause PTSD, just as, people who are war journalists, war reporters, they come back with PTSD, even though they're not actually fighting on the front lines. They're just reporting from
Well, I
the
think
front
it's
lines.
millions of people now just switch off. They're not interested anymore in seeing this stuff because they find it, they'd much rather focus on their job, their family, their home.
And the financial economic situation in many countries is such that they really have no option but to do that, because if they, they can't make ends meet if they don't work every hour God sends. So, but the mood in the US is very anti this war. I mean, this war on Iran currently. And the younger generation is clearly, they've lost the younger generation. They lost them on Gaza, and they are going to lose them on Iran, because, of course, the targeting of that girls' primary school in Iran, and then, they targeted a gymnasium with volleyball players, all girls as well, and subsequently hospitals and so on. I mean, the fact that this satanic entity of the Anglo, well, at the moment it's the American Zio cabal, they are committing these crimes against humanity. And people, the young people, are not going to buy the justifications that that they trot out, you know, that, oh, the school was close to an IRGC training camp or whatever. They're not going to buy those lame excuses. So they have a real problem. They have a real problem in terms of perception management, which is why the Israeli lobby and all of their main benefactors are determined to flood the airwaves and all the influencer channels and all various platforms with their inversion of the truth, you know, their manipulation of the truth. I don't know if it will work. I don't think
well,
it's
maybe
going to
they don't
change
care.
Anything.
Maybe they've realized what we're controlling all these elite institutions now and the military, and we're just going to go for it. And let's let the perception management, psychological warfare people, just so long as we keep you know, pro-Iranian views, pro-Russian views off the airwaves, then they see they can get away with things. But look, I think I have to ask you finally about whether you think that international law is dead, whether internal law in the United States, where the democratic institutions are supposed to get a vote on war, but they haven't. We're already participating in Britain. It seems it'd be a slippery slope to us getting more involved, especially if there's a false flag in Cyprus or something. What do you think of the, you know, where do we stand when it comes to the law now? That it seems like the people who are supposed to be in charge of it, whether it's the UN or the or our parliaments or Congress or the House of Representatives, just aren't interested.
Well, it is dead. I mean, it died a long time ago, but it died most evidently post 7th of October 2023. So I don't think that's in doubt, you know. What I'm most concerned about really is this idea that the, as you call it, the accelerationists, the dark enlightened folk, you know, they refer to the academia, media, and government, civil society as the cathedral. This is the term that Curtis Yarvin uses for the non-corporate world, and basically he argues that the cathedral has had too much influence on society for the last 100 to 200 years, and you know, we need corporations to take over. So all of these things, this sense, this real acknowledgement that international law is dead and that all of our establishments are failing us and they're not representing us and that they're corrupt, they're all involved in the Epstein's scandal, and all of this combined with all the woke nonsense and all the rest of it, is really creating a feeling amongst many people that they don't represent us anymore, and that all of those things are really worthless. And I think this is dangerous. Not that I'm advocating for the current iterations of these things, but it's dangerous because they are the actual people who are pushing all these agendas are the ones who are trying, who are deliberately forcing the cathedral out of the arena so that there will no longer be anybody that will represent us apart from a bot or a corporate agent. So I think this is something that I don't see many people talking about, I don't know if you do. And anybody who says we need to get rid of all of these institutions is basically
Well,
you're sort of
they're
sinking
playing
your
into
own
the accel
boat.
they're playing
Yeah,
into
you're
the
playing.
acceleration's hands, aren't they?
Right, precisely, precisely. And as I say, I'm not in favor of what is currently, the status quo, because it is corrupt. It has been undermined. It has been completely overwhelmed by corporate money, and all of the regulations have been reduced to nothing. So we need people to start thinking about how do we create a system that represents us, that is in our interest, that allows us to thrive, and not to fall into this trap that the only solution is to get rid of all of these things and hand it over to a corporate entity.
Well, that would mean that the only activities that happen, the only thinking that happens, is that something which will bring a profit, a financial profit through a company and a corporation, and everything else is banned.
Right, and then people don't actually, people aren't cottoning onto this, that everything that is being sold to you at the minute as part of the NHS or whatever isn't, it is already this private thing. So when they tell you to wear these, wearables to monitor your various, all your heart rate and all the rest of it, that is a private thing. They are doing that for private interests. They are feeding the data machine with your data for a purpose. And they're trying to tell you that they can diagnose what is going to happen to you in the near future. So they're seeding this narrative that they have more knowledge of how your body is working than you yourself does. And the same goes for hospital protocols. They've created all these protocols now, so that when you go to the hospital, they will go, well, this is what we need to do, A, B, C, X, Y, Z. And if you try to challenge that and you're not happy with that, then they will say, well, I'm sorry, but you're not cooperating, and so therefore we're under no obligation to treat you, and so on and so forth. And this goes throughout. It goes to education. When you're challenging teachers on lecturers on certain topics, well, you're this doesn't agree with our policies. These are, you're offending people. This is harmful. This is hurtful. So, you're going to be excluded. All of this is part and parcel of predictive behavior, predictive pre-crime, which they're also pushing this idea of, based on people's behaviors online and their various movements around town and so on, is a prediction of their likelihood to commit a crime. It's a very, very dystopic.
Well, I predict that they are criminals.
We know they are criminals. No prediction required. So
look.
I think we have to understand that all of this stuff is part of their private network. And so I would advise people not to get these technological sort of things that they want you to wear on your body and so on, and not to support their collection of your private data. For example, Sainsbury's rolling out facial recognition cameras in their stores at the at the entrance to, to do what? To prevent people stealing from the shop, which previously they had a hands-off approach to people stealing anything conveniently, so that now they can use it as an excuse to surveil people going in. Well, we need to push back on all of this data collection.
I mean,
And
all the
since
supermarkets since COVID have really gone over to controlling people's movements around the supermarket, which of course it means potentially anyway some kind of computer deciding whether or not you're allowed to enter.
right, and if you go in and you create a fuss for whatever reason, for example, if you see Israeli grapefruits or Israeli I don't know what, avocados or what have you, and you decide to do a protest and sort of throw them on the floor, then you could be potentially barred from that shop, any of its branches around the country. Your name could
All
go
over
on a
the
database
world.
all over the world, right? So it's, a lot of people just go along with it because, they think, what's the harm? I've got nothing to hide. But ultimately, something will affect you. Something won't be to your liking, and then you'll discover that you're on your own. You can't protest because it's been outlawed.
Well, it seems to me a kind of animal farm has been created for us digitally, and we are just kind of wandering around and wandering into it and wandering through it and giving it all the data that you're talking about. I think Sam William in London, his channel Sam Williamism, is doing quite a good job in showing what an amazing technological dystopia London is slowly becoming. With its various kind of monitoring of everybody. But anyway, look, you've mentioned a few people. You mentioned Ryan Dawson, you mentioned Brian Beletic, you mentioned
Justin
Justin
Poddard.
Poddard. Can you just spell Justin Poddard for us?
Yeah, it's Poddhur.
And
I
whereabouts do
think.
people find and follow you online, Catherine, if people are interested?
I'm simply on Telegram, basically. Yeah, Catherine Gunn, but I never know how to tell people where to go on Telegram.
Well, they can search for your name, which is spelt Katharine, Gunn, with a Gun, not two N's. Anyway, Catherine,
Yeah,
thanks
there's
again for joining us.
thank you, Tony. Bye for now.